Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 366 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host, as usual. You know, last week, I think I forgot to identify that I was the host. I hope people figured that out. Anyway, today my guest is Corey Kupfer. Corey is an attorney at the heart of things, dealing mostly with high-level business law, mergers, acquisitions, deal-making, all that kind of good stuff. But he's really a highly sought after and well-recognized content creator in the area of deal making and has authored a book called Authentic Negotiating, Clarity, Detachment, and Equilibrium, The Three Keys to Negotiating Success and How to Achieve Them, as well as being the host of the very popular Deal Quest podcast, which is kind of just an extension of who he is and the kind of work that he does in his content marketing world. And we have this really broad discussion where we talk about, you know, how he entered the practice of law and built his business to the point where we also spend a good amount of time talking about one of his passion projects, which is bringing diversity to the legal space and to the entrepreneurial and business development space. And he does more than just use that as a buzzword. He lives that concept fully and completely. So it's a great conversation, in my humble opinion. I hope you enjoy it. And without any further delay, here is Corey Kupfer. Corey Kupfer, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
It's great to be with you, Neil.
Well, I'm really happy to have you with us today, Corey. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I was actually a little unusual in that I was in this law, politics, and community affairs program in Brooklyn, New York in high school that got me interested in law. So when I say I was unusual, I went into college sort of knowing I wanted to be a lawyer. Of course, I didn't really know what that meant because in high school was, you know, mock presidential elections and visiting courtrooms and, you know, jails and nothing that has to do with what I do now as a lawyer. But I got in my head, I want to be a lawyer. So I started college with that idea and then, you know, went straight through and became a lawyer. A lot of my other friends who became lawyers were just, you know, smart folks who did well in college. And it was like, all right, what do I do next? Law school or MBA, right? Well, they came to later. So did the big firm, you know, did the big law thing for a few years and went to a medium-sized firm. And then about 6 years out of school, I knew I didn't want to work for somebody for the rest of my life. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. My only decision was, did I want to stay in law or did I want to, you know, open up some other kind of business? And I had actually gone straight through. You know, I came from a low and middle class family and like it wasn't on the menu to take a year off skiing or backpack around Europe. So it was high school, college, law school and then a job. So I actually took off. I skied 42 days. This was end of 91 into 92 and took some time off to try to figure out what I wanted to do. And then I realized that actually most of what I didn't like about practicing law back then was related to working for someone else. And, you know, it was what I knew and it's where I had some contacts, although I didn't really have a book of business because, you know, those days, big and medium-sized law, they discourage you from developing your own business. And then, of course, you needed to have a book to become a partner. So I started with nothing, but I hung out a shingle and, you know, built it up from zero.
And what area of law were you practicing at the time, or did that shift along the way?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I won't get into the whole early story, but Cliff Note version is that for some reason coming out, you know, I took some courses and I thought it was cool and I thought I wanted to be a management side labor law attorney. And I had done, I'd worked in-house. I was very fortunate to get a first summer job, you know, between my first and second year of law school at General Foods in their in-house labor law department. I thought that's what I wanted to do. And second summer, I worked at Saifaw Shaw, which at the time was, you know, arguably the top labor law firm in the country. It's before Proskauer and some of these other, Epstein back on some of these other firms, you know, really grew that practice area. So I got my plum job, you know, I got an offer after second year, and I thought I was going to be a management side labor law attorney. And then in between, you know, my summer and when I came back permanently, they brought in a new guy to head up the labor department who, frankly, was a real jerk and horrible guy to work for. And at the same time, it was the, you know, it was September, I started September of 85. So we're coming into the 86 tax law changes and the corporate and deal side and security side of stuff at the firm was really, really busy. And although I had arrogantly negotiated a guarantee I'd be in the labor law department, as you know, as those things go and you learn life lessons, I was asked to help out if I give up my guarantee to in the corporate securities department. And I loved it. And I ended up, you know, splitting time in my first year. And then in my second year, coming into my second year, the young partners called me aside and said, hey, Corey, we'd love to, you know, they come into the department full time. We're going to be hiring a bunch of people. And it was the '80s. It was a big go time, you know, and I'm going to get fifth year level work in your second year. And so I committed to it and I haven't turned back. You know, that's mainly, you know, that's what I do. Although when I did hang out my shingle and start my firm, I will say I started doing a lot of stuff just in the beginning, just to, you know, pay the bills. But fortunately, within about a year and a half, I was able to focus back on the corporate contract side of things.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You talk about, you know, all the way back in high school, being part of, you know, something that led you to believe that you're going to be a lawyer, not knowing really what all that meant. I can't tell you how many people we've talked to who decided they wanted to be an attorney simply by, you know, a TV show they watched. And you can really gauge the age of that infatuation, because if there are people like me, you know, they started watching what was then the original Perry Mason and wanted to be an attorney. And then you went to like LA Law and Boston Law and you know, eventually Law and Order. So you can really kind of characterize people by what legal TV show resonated with them. I find it interesting that on, you know, at the beginning of the process, you focused on management side labor. And then towards the end, it was more on the deal making side and the securities side. And, you know, both were hot topics in those days. And,
oh, sure.
You know, I'm good. But maybe you could shed some light. I still think mergers, deal making, you know, business development, that never goes away, does it?
Yeah. I mean, listen, we certainly had, it's been a great run. Certainly, I'd say almost never. So 2008, 2009, Great Recession. It went away.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It certainly got tampered down, didn't it?
No, but one of the things I said, but you're right in that, I say this all the time on my DealQuest podcast, and I thought, you know, the truth is I say it went away. There's always deals that are happening. And in fact, there are just different types of deals that happen in bad economies, right? Or in challenging times. In fact, some of the greatest deal opportunities happen in that time. It just may be when financing dries up and the economy is tough, that deal volumes will drop for a while until the market adjusts, and you know, and then it'll pick up again.
Now, I noticed that, you know, when we were talking before, that along the way you've had, you know, as all of us have, a lot of life experiences and things that have gone into shaping who we are, but very specifically, it's shaped in your situation a very tangible understanding of how business works, and particularly the role of negotiations in business. I mean, I think a lot of times when we think of attorneys in the deal-making process and the negotiating process, it's always an I win, you lose model. And that's how we typically, I think, sometimes think of it. And you come to a perspective that's far different.
Yeah, no question about it. And that, you know, and I, in my authentic negotiating book, I give some of that backstory with two, you know, senior partners that I worked for in my early days and contrasting their two styles and what I learned from it. And you know, what, and it's been confirmed over time. I mean, one of the things I often say about negotiating in deals is that most business negotiations, one of two things is true. Very often, they are actually in anticipation of a new business relationship or a continuation of an existing business relationship, right? If you merge, sure. You know, your firm, you're getting acquired and you're staying on. I mean, not, you know, in many cases, people stay on. They don't totally exit, you know, or you're doing any kind of distribution deal or joint venture, strategic alliance, a licensing deal, you name it, right? You know, these are ongoing business relationships. So, you know, if you use your leverage or tactics or whatever it is to quote unquote win a negotiation, that's the start of a relationship. What does that do for you? I mean, what you find is actually people who get beat up in a negotiation in the ongoing relationship, they're going to try to find ways to get that back, right? Whether it's, you know,
honey, get back or get out.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, right. Or, you know, whatever it is. So it just doesn't make any, I mean, you know, even if we take off the table just what I consider ethics and character and integrity and all that kind of stuff, on a practical basis, it's just not smart. And then even if it is one of those deals where you don't have any kind of ongoing business relationships, maybe you're just buying hard assets from whatever, you know, it's not just a cliche. It's a small world and people get reputations, you know, especially in the business and deal world. You know, you might be able to pull it off one or two, you know, a couple of times, but, you know, it gets known that you operate that way, and then your deal flow is going to dry up. People aren't going to want to do business with you. So, you know, even if if you don't have a moral ethical pulling, which I think you should, I don't know if we use the word should, but when that, but I do believe you should there. It's just not smart business. So, and frankly, it's less effective than some of the things that I talk about, which is, you know, in when I say less effective, I'm not talking about achieving a short-term result. I'm talking about we should be looking at the more holistic, bigger picture. And why are we even doing these deals? Why are we even in these negotiations? What is our ultimate goal? What are we trying to achieve? And if you want to do that, I mean, win-win has become a cliche. I mean, I've had the pleasure of spending time with William Ury, who wrote the classic negotiating book, Getting to Yes, and that whole conversation. Unfortunately, it's become a cliche that people say whether they mean it or not. But the truth is, if you really look at the context of it, you know, we want to build successful ongoing relationships with great people. That's how you be successful in business. And you're not going to do that if you're taking advantage of people in a negotiation.
I one time heard somebody actually tell me this. We were talking about the concept of win-win. And they said, well, really what I shoot for is for me to win a little more and you to win a little less. Well, that's not really win-win now, is it? So, well, yeah, you're getting something out of it, but I'm getting something more. Okay. I can hear, to a degree, some of our audience saying, well, okay, I get that if you're working at, you know, this big corporate level or, you know, higher levels of business, we're putting together these mega deals and big structures of things. But hey, I'm a solo practitioner. I'm a small firm. You know, I might be working in the business community, but I may really just be working with clients and dealing with their lives, their divorces, their estate plans, their criminal activity. You know, how can I bring those lessons that you learn in an environment such as you've been in? How can I bring that to the table on a smaller scale? And how could I then leverage that to become more of an entrepreneur and see growth as a result?
Yeah, it's a great question. So here's the thing about it. First of all, for attorneys, our reputation, our integrity, you know, who we are as people, over decades of a career is really what's going to, you know, sustain us, right? Because there's going to be ups and downs in the economy. There's going to be challenging times. You know, there's going to be situations that come up, right? And we're not selling widgets. We don't have a product, right? We're you know, in that group that I call not only service providers, but like ultimate service providers, right? You know, lawyers, doctors, various professions where I'm not denigrating any other profession, but you know, like what we do is very often very crucial for our clients. It makes a big difference, whether it's a big deal, whether it's a divorce situation, you know, whether it's, you know, helping somebody buy their first home, right? Whatever it is, these are important things to our clients and they're meaningful. You know, they're big, right? So
sure.
You know, if we are, you know, so whether it's in negotiating or any way else, if we are operating, you know, with that integrity and that builds trust in our reputation, And listen, I think that was always the case, but nowadays, especially with, with online, with the internet and how easy it is, for word to get around, if we don't treat people right, if we don't act in the right way, if we, bully people or we just don't do a job well, it's become even more crucial. And, now with, the hot topic now is AI, right? And, I see all these talks about how AI, people are worried that AI is going to replace us as lawyers. And I'm not worried about that at all, not because I'm ahead of the stand or I'm stupid about it, but because I think people who use those kind of tools to help them leverage and grow and do stuff that, it makes sense for technology to do, are really going to, do really well. And frankly, if we are providing the level of service that we do to our clients, which, should not just be, pumping out the same. I mean, sure, technology is going to be able to pump out competitive stuff, but what I do, at least, and I even think folks who do any other kind of practice, the level of your strategic ability and the empathy and the ability to deal with clients, I mean, whether it's a divorce or whether it's a deal, that's something that's not going to be able to be duplicated by technology, and that's what's going to distinguish and should distinguish us now, will continue to distinguish us in the future and create an ability for us to continue to grow our businesses, our firms.
Along those lines, I think I mentioned to you again earlier that, there's a certain mindset that causes attorneys to step out and start their own practice, whether it be a solo or a small firm. And, one of the things we've learned across this 366 episodes of doing this podcast is that a journey is different for a lot of folks. Sometimes a solo practice is thrust upon them by circumstances, and other times they've decided to make that leap on their own. But what I find is that the ones who do so successfully, always in the back of their minds knew that they wanted to be their own boss, or they wanted to create something. They had that entrepreneurial, spirit. And as a result, I see even more often those same people, they keep having their eyes open for entrepreneurial opportunities that may involve, expanding their practice, but may involve getting into completely different areas. And how do you, what's your advice for kind of tapping into that? If you find you have that burning desire, how do you tap into that and manifest it into something real?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it manifests in various ways. I mean, I'm one of those people, definitely feel like I'm a natural born entrepreneur, right? I was, doing hustling as a kid. I ran a business at 15 with it's called contractors. I wasn't withholding taxes at 15. In a flyer delivery business where I got my own accounts with, after working with somebody doing that as a 15-year-old kid. So I had that natural, thing. And you're right. The ones, some people leave, and basically become self-employed, sit in bill hours, get a job. And I have no judgment on that. You can make a very honest living much better than a lot of people in a lot of other professions. But then there's, some of us who, are really, looking for all those opportunities. And I have a few things on that, because I've had, a journey over the last several decades around that. And there's a lot that's great about that. And then there's some cautionary things. So the cautionary thing I'll go to first, which is that, it's easy, like, early on, I was involved in a lot of ventures as well. I had my law firm, and then I had some friends who were building tech ventures and other stuff, and I was involved in that and taking pieces of equity and things like that. And then, I had some interest in the nonprofit area, as well. And what I made a mistake of early on in my practice was that I would get distracted from my main business on a bunch of this other stuff, right, which was sort of shiny and fun, and that's, what entrepreneurs do, right? It's easy to go through any thing. But at that point, and I'm going back, 25 years or whatever, at that point, my core business was not solid enough, and it was much more dependent upon me.
Yeah, upon you, yeah.
Yeah, it would drop because I'm doing all these other things, and then I have to, wait a second, business is down, where whatever, client service is starting to suffer, I got to go back into the core business, and I got to make sure, and it would be sort of this roller coaster. And I learned, pretty early on that, wait a second. So then I took some time and focused on the law firm, right? And I created a firm where I had other people working for me. I mean, frankly, it's very tough as a solo in any field of the law to do a lot else outside of it. I mean, yeah, you can take the money you make and make maybe make it passive investments in your real estate or in some of your what your clients are doing or whatever else it is, you know. But to be involved in other stuff, it's challenging if you haven't built a team. And for me, that's the biggest thing I've done well over the last number of years is, you know, I have other attorneys that work for me. I mean, I'll just, you know, give you an example.
Yeah,
you know, but most attorneys, right, they're billing, what, 1,800, 2,000 bigger firms or something, or maybe if you really house to sell, you can, you know, 2,200, 2,400, whatever it is, right? I try to bill under 300 hours a year. Last year, I was at like 350. Not because, you know, I'm not trying to work. I do a lot of work that's not billable. My role is I bring in the business. I handle the high-level strategy and structuring, negotiating, and, you know, high-level client contact. But then I have a team, my lawyers, my, you know, assistants, paralegals, you know, who really, you know, do a lot of the drafting and reviewing of documents and day-to-day client stuff, right? And of course, they go at lower rates for me, which makes sense for the client for what they're, you know, and then the client only pays my rate for the stuff that is, you know, that I sort of only I can handle. What that does is also free me up, but that takes some time to build the systems, the people, getting the right team in place, you know, creating the right messaging out to the client so that they understand that they're better off as well. They don't need access to me personally all the time. They're actually better off, you know, working with my team on a lot of stuff and calling me in when they need me. So I focused on getting that in place. And then I was really freed up to go out. You know, I created some real estate investment funds where we, you know, did some condo conversions and bought sold real estate. I've invested in some, you know, tech companies and some of my clients, you know, businesses, which, you know, you have appropriate disclosures and that kind of stuff. And I have my speaking, training, and consulting company. So, you know, the book out, the podcast, I do professional speaking and some workshops and stuff like that. And I can do all that without the core business, the law firm, suffering because I have the right systems and team in place.
Support for today's episode comes from Ruby, the number one client communication solution for growing legal practices. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Ruby creates exceptional experiences for your callers and website visitors. They take messages, screen and transfer callers, schedule appointments, perform new client intake, confirm details with outbound calls, and can answer in English and Spanish, and a whole lot more. Just like an in-house receptionist, only better, because they turn every ring into a relationship. Ruby can work full-time, part-time, or as a backup, and you can change your instructions anytime with their top-rated mobile app and online dashboard. Plus, Ruby integrates with tools such as Clio, Lexaclara, MyCase, and Rocket Matter. It all adds up to more opportunities and more time saved. In fact, 90% of legal professionals who use Ruby capture more billable hours than the national average, with many recording double or more. That's 5 or more billable hours per day. To experience the Ruby difference for yourself, visit get.ruby.com/ELE. That's get.ruby.com/TLE, as in the law entrepreneur, for up to $150 off your first month. Imagine you, powered by Ruby. As a law firm owner, you take responsibility for driving more revenue for your firm. But how much of that revenue ends up as bottom line profit? Ryan Kimmler, the net profit CFO, helps law firms drive more top line revenue to bottom line profit. His two game changing tools are the scorecard, so you can actually know what your numbers are and can make informed decisions, and the action plan, so you know how to get your numbers where you want them to be and drive more net profit. To learn more about Ryan, check out episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, and you can get a free profit acceleration call by going to go.oncehub, that's O-N-C-E-H-U-B, go.oncehub.com/profit. I will also tell you, just as an aside, I am a client of Ryan's. I've been working with him for the past 6 months. Frankly, ever since he did that episode with me, I signed on with him to be a client. And I've been thrilled with the kind of information and insight he's been able to give me. So do yourself a favor, you know, get that free call and check out Ryan Kimmler at netprofit.com.
Well, I want to talk about, you know, some of those things that this level of delegation afforded you the opportunity to do. You really breezed by it earlier, and I want to kind of circle back to the fact you have a very successful and very highly thought of book, authoring The Authentic Negotiating, Clarity, Detachment, and Equilibrium, the three keys to negotiating success and how to achieve them. Tell me a little bit about how that book came about.
Yeah.
And what kind of, if not doors that it's opened for you, what kind of revelations the whole experience has generated for you?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I had been doing some, you know, speaking on negotiating, and, you know, my speaking really came out organically. People would just get to know me and, you know, they would ask me to speak. And one of the topics I spoke about was negotiating. And I had developed this particular philosophy on how, you know, on how we do it that's different, which we alluded to a little bit in the beginning. And at some point, a combination of two things happened. One, I started hearing about this thing called authority marketing, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, what is that? And one of the things that I did well over the years, and then one of the things I was frustrated at building my business up to that point was I was great at building relationships, getting referrals, right? Centers of influence, key people, investment bankers, accountants, whoever it was. And in the beginning, when I didn't have a lot of clients, it was easy to, you know, to make sure I stay top of mind with my client base. But as we grew, it becomes much more difficult, right, to stay top of mind. And whenever, you know, in any true entrepreneur, you know, whenever you hear of a client of yours or even, you know, a referral source to send business elsewhere, you know, who did something, you know, they did a deal and did something and they used someone else. And then they're like, you know, they say to you, oh, wow, you do that too, right? Or like, I didn't remember that. Or maybe, you know, that other person had been in contact with them. You know, a lot of corporate deal, or with, you know, everybody listening to this, whatever you do, there's a lot of people who do it, right? So the question is, you know, how do you make sure you stay top of mind? And it used to drive me crazy because, you know, if you remember in the old days, there were some services that produced these snail mail newsletters where they give you
one
set and you put your logo on it. But they were never great, right? Like I never did it because I didn't love it. And a lot of people were doing it. It didn't distinguish us. So, you know, I try to meet with clients. I try to go out to lunch. I try to reach out and call them. But again, it becomes more difficult as you grow. So this authority marketing thing, I'm like, well, wait a second. I can keep top of mind. And, you know, also obviously it relates to social media, which at the time, and I'm only going back 5-6 years and go, you know, I had a LinkedIn account with a bunch of connections I didn't know what to do with. I had a personal Facebook page, but I wasn't doing anything on the business side really with social. So
very few of us knew what to do with all those resources.
Exactly. Like, right. I'm not looking for a job. I know LinkedIn does that.
Right.
What does it do? Right back then. So, you know, so I really bought into this conversation of content, you know, being kings or queens, so to speak, and also, you know, establishing yourself as an authority and, you know, being able to give value on a broader basis. And it started with the book, and then in anticipation of the book, I started working with a social media team to put out content to tease the book. And then I said, okay, even coming to thinking about a book, my wife actually said to me, Corey, you have such a unique approach to negotiating. It's helped so many people. You have such success. You really should write a book about it. You know, you don't want to, she's literally said to me, you don't want to die with this information in you. I was like, do you think I'm going anywhere? Yeah. You know, like, should I know something? You know?
Yeah. What?
So
I don't.
Right. Exactly. Did you up the insurance recently? You know,
yeah.
But so any case, you know, but she, you know, she was really saying, hey, you know, you have something to offer here. And, you know, a big part of what drives me is being of service, you know, to people. And this is a way to be of service on a broader, you know, basis. So I researched, you know, the different options, you know, getting a major book deal, self-publishing. And there was I've been a member of entrepreneurs organization at this point now since 2008. But, you know, 6 years ago, whatever, there was a guy, you know, I learned about these models, including one that was run by an ER out of Charleston. That was what's called a hybrid publisher. And on a hybrid publisher, they help, they get you a co-writer. They help, you know, they really help soup to nuts, the cover design, well, everything. You pay them for it, so you're not getting an advance. The opposite way, you pay them for it. But it was designed for busy professionals, and it was sort of a turnkey solution. Now, for me, and they had something called the Talk Your Book program. So I literally got on the, and you know, having given talks already about negotiating. I knew my content. So I got on the phone with a writer, and they produced a first draft for me out of those conversations. Now, what some people do is that they do minor edits and they put it out there. For me, I was really intent that there was value through every page. You know, there's sort of a joke that goes around the entrepreneurial community about most business books actually should be an article, and then they have 150 extra pages that say the same thing over again. Yeah. And I never wanted my book to be able to say that. So I actually did two major rewrites on it myself to get it to the level I wanted it to be. But in any case, so I published the book with them, and initially they helped me market it. And then I changed to, another marketing company that we use now for the book and the podcast and everything. And what I found was that it achieved those purposes. First of all, it got the value that I had to provide, in service out to more people. Second of all, it gets you speaking engagements, and podcast interviews on other people's podcasts. Once you have a book, there's a credibility factor. We could have a whole discussion on whether or not there should be, but there still is, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that I made sure I thought my book really provided value, that's the feedback I got, was great. And I would get all these people, they would talk about the book, they would post about it, they would ask me about it. It became a credibility factor for, potential clients that I'd written a book on negotiating. And then, the same thing. And the other big thing is that most people don't understand the book scenario. Something like 90+% of the books sell less than 300 copies. So you're not going to get rich off a book. You use the book. The book is an ultimate calling card, right? I sell books, but I give away as many books as I sell.
Sure.
And, you have to put a business model around it like anything else. Same thing with my podcast. I studied the podcast model for a year, and I put a business model around it. And all of those things have achieved the purpose. I mean, what I say to people is, yes, have I gotten direct business because of the book and the podcast? Absolutely. But even more so, almost to a person, if I haven't talked to somebody in a little while, one of the first things they say to me when we connect is, hey, read your book. Let's listen to your podcast. Oh, been looking at the content you've been doing on LinkedIn. It's been great. So I know now I'm keeping top of mind, and I also know our growth rates over the last 5 years since we started doing this, which have been very significant. And can I tie it dollar for dollar to this? No, but I know it's made a huge, huge difference with our firm and who we can help.
Our journey is very similar in that regard when I started the podcast. And I remember when I did so, I was thinking about a really good friend of mine. I was the best man in his wedding, no longer with us, rest his soul. But he had an interview program on the local public access television channel. And I said to him one time, Tom, why are you spending so much time doing this interview show on public access TV? Nobody's watching it. He said, of course not. He said, so I don't have to worry about getting it right. He said, but as a calling card for potential sources, referral sources and centers of influence, when I say to them, hey, you want to come on my TV show?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever turned me down.
Right.
And I've gotten tons of business from that as a relationship building tool.
100%.
And I think that's what we sometimes overlook. That's when he says to, well, have you monetized your podcast? Have you monetized the book that you wrote? Can you track it, your return on investment? And as you said, maybe not one for one, action for action, but I know the business has gotten better, and I know that the reputation in the community is better. And, I can point all that to, as you said, the book or the podcast or the content marketing. One person said to me one time, valuable knowledge never fails to produce.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never goes away. Never goes away. If it's valuable knowledge, it's always going to generate something. I think where we fall into a trap is thinking what we believe is knowledgeable. Because your belief isn't really knowledge, is it? And so,
right.
So I think that's the key. One of the things that also struck me was I was going through your material is you make a very, I don't know if concerted effort is the right phrase, but diversity is a fully formed aspect of the content of what you think in terms of negotiating and team building and business relationships. And, you know, I think we give that word short shrift sometimes, or we throw it around without meaning, but you've actually kind of lived that whole experience. And, you know, we're not part of the diverse culture, you and I. So how do we incorporate that into our business? And I think you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's. I appreciate you asking about that. You know, it's interesting because I'll answer the question. I'll tell you a little bit about the journey because I think this will be useful to listeners. So, you know, one of the things that I would do, I mentioned, you know, in addition to the other business endeavors, when I was able to, you know, get my firm to a place where I could be a little freed up, I also, you know, pursued things I was passionate about, right? It gave me time to do that. And diversity and, you know, race relations and bringing people together across perceived differences is a passion of mine, right? I believe we're ultimately all one humanity. I've had the pleasure of amazing experiences of traveling and being in villages in Ghana and Uganda and India and various places, and traveling all over the world and been in Nepal, whenever. And what I find, you know, my fundamental belief is that as human beings, you know, most people are very, very similar. Everybody's just trying to live a better life, provide for their kids, you know, educate them if they have a place, if they live in a country where that's available. You know, the fundamental values are very, you know, when you get to the political level or you get to, you know, certain radical extremists, obviously it's different, but you know, the far majority of people are just, and when you have that experience and you connect with people, you find that. So, I was the founder of something called the Conversations About Race Project, in which people have one-on-one cross-cultural dialogues about race. And we did that in college campuses and community groups and at the World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa. And, you know, there's all this stuff that I've done in that area. But for a while, it was sort of separate. It was this other stuff that I did. And I sort of had my lawyer persona, and then I had my activist persona, and then I had, and, you know, a lot of us have that. You know, and I don't have any judgment against that, whatever, you know, you show up as appropriate in a particular circumstance. But I sort of came to a journey where I was like, you know, listen, I want to be able to be fully who I am and wherever I show up, right? I don't want to compartmentalize the parts of me. You know, and I never felt like I was disingenuous to anybody. I would just only sort of show certain parts, you know, there's various parts of us that are authentic, but I would choose which ones would show up in different situations. And when I decided to let go of that, be able to just be fully who I am, and, you know, I think people, even if they are not passionate about what you're passionate about, frankly, you know, if for a lot of people, even if they don't necessarily agree with what you agree with, that you know, if you're not judgmental of them and they're not just well you, they respect the passion and commitment to, you know, what you're involved in. And actually, they think more highly of you. That's not the reason I do it, but that's one of the results. So you know, that shows up in the projects I do, but it also shows up every day. I mean, you know, I've over time had all kinds of diversity within my firm in terms of the, you know, the people who work with me, because I'm really open to it. And then, you know, I also helped found one of the early diversity initiatives in the Entrepreneurs Organization, the New York chapter. We called it EO 2030. And there's a huge business case for it, right? So even if it's not one of these things that you're just called to out of, you know, out of, like I am as a calling. I mean, my view is if you're a smart business person, you want to be able to be attractive to the broadest base of clients or customers. You want to be able to recruit and hire from the broadest pool of talent, right? And you want to get, and there's, you know, all kinds of studies that show that different perspectives, right? Whether it's, and I'm talking about racial, ethnic, you know, gender diversity, but also, you know, even just, you know, where, could be where people live or their backgrounds or whatever, you know, different perspectives really make you and, you know, in terms of personal growth and certainly businesses and organizations better. So I think there's a huge business case for diversity, right? Thinking and things like that. And you know, it's become, it's been something I believe that, and now it's been, you know, it's for many years now, it's something that I just fully integrate. I don't hide it. What, you know, it's like, I mean, you brought it up, right? It's part of who I am. And
yeah, it is part of you, who you are, and it you give meaning to the phrase "you walk the walk," because it's not just something you speak about. I mean, it's something that you live. And you know, I really appreciate the fact that you put it in business terms as well, because I never really understood. If I only hired people that looked like me, and I only served people that looked like me, there's a whole community out there that's three times bigger, four times bigger.
That's right.
Look like me, so why wouldn't it? If my idea is to grow, why would I consciously, limit to whom I can offer my services? I never really understood that. And then, yeah. And then folks who say, well, I can add it on later. Well, no, it's not like something, it's not like I can change the colors of my logo later. you're either committed to this and you see people as people, or you don't, in my humble opinion.
I think
you and I share that same kind of view.
Yeah. And there's two things. Listen, in the U.S. here, I mean, the demographics are heading in a direction where there's fewer of, you and I, right?
Old fat white guys like me. if my market is only old fat white guys, my market is shrinking.
Exactly right. And here's the thing about it. We can spend hours on this. We won't. But the thing is, a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of listeners would say, well, listen, I believe in all this. I'm open to all of it.
Open-minded. Yeah.
I'm open-minded, but it takes more than that, right? Because the thing is, a lot of us have, a lot of, not only lawyers, but, all kinds of people have a bunch of people who look like them, think like them, or from where they're from, whatever, not because they consciously discriminated, but it's because that's the only circles they travel in. So that's the only opportunity they have to meet folks. So it takes expanding your circles. It takes, one of the reasons why I have access to talent and clients and all that kind of stuff in various communities is I spend time in various
communities,
walking to them, just like being in them. Now, listen, because of my commitment to this work and out of the Conversations About Race project that I created, I actually met my wife, who's African-American. So we've been together 22 years now. So, but not just that. I mean, I just spend time in other communities so it takes more than an openness. It takes a conscious effort and plan to, get yourself out there and expose yourself more to different groups and learn cultures and get comfortable and be open and then build trust. Because let's face it, the best way that we grow our business is that we build trust in more and more people who feel comfortable giving us their business and referring us.
Now, will I still make mistakes?
Sure.
Of course. But I hope people understand it's not anything malicious. I screwed up. continue to do that. Anyway, let's plug your podcast. Tell the audience a little bit about the podcast, what it does, where can it be found, and we'll wrap it up with that.
Sure. Thank you. So it's the Deal Quest podcast. That's one word, Deal Quest. It's interesting. In the context of this conversation of, other attorneys and growing the business, I started the podcast as another way to do that authority marketing. But also I knew, I looked at a lot, there's a lot of different things you can do, right? And for me, people write a lot of articles, things like that, right? For me, the speaking thing is just much more natural. I like it. And the idea of interviewing people and talking about deals of all types, it is fun to me, right? It's exciting. I love doing it. It's a passion. So I said, all right, I want to do the deals podcast. I want to do it a little differently in that there are a number of M&A podcasts out there, and there are capital raising podcasts out there, the general entrepreneurial podcasts out there, but there aren't that many podcasts out there that talk about all types of deals, not sales, not organic growth, but also not just M&A and capital raising. So we talk about it, plenty of M&A and capital raising, but we also talk about joint ventures, strategic alliances, and licensing deals, and real estate deals, and online affiliate deals, and sponsorship deals, anything that is inorganic, that's non-organic, that's not the sales and marketing and providing great products and services and getting referrals, some of the stuff we've been talking about in terms of how I grow my firm organically, but anything that's a deal. And the theory on it was, hey, first of all, I love doing this. Second of all, it'll be that authority marketing. I'll build that guest strategy you talked about, right? Building relationships. And in the beginning, the first year, we launched it. Of course, I was calling my clients and EO friends and colleagues and buddy and say, hey, I need guests on my podcast. Please come on, right? And, that's how we had guests in the beginning. And I do three interviews and then a solo cast and three interviews and a solo cast. And then just because of the entrepreneurial spirit you were talking about before, I'm always looking at ways, I'm studying the model, always looking at ways to improve it. And I almost can't like just do something casually. So, you know, I got the right marketing team in place. I started figuring out certain things about the podcast. And in any case, you know, we've gone from like being happy when I had 60 or 80 people listening to an episode in those beginning years. And you know, I get my friends and clients to come on and test to, you know, having an incoming flow of guest requests all the time. We have vetting forms, like, you know, we have all the podcast brokers or whatever are sending us people. You know, Listen Notes has us at top 1% out of over 3 million podcasts in terms of, you know, reach. You know, we have close to 40,000 listeners a month, you know, now on the podcast. So we're getting, you know, 8,000, 9,000
a week
per episode. And really, you know, and I'm not saying that to, you know, but it's because I think that it's something that was aligned with who I am. Like, I would still be doing it now for 60 or 80 listeners because I love doing it. I love having the conversations. I love meeting my guests. I love talking deals. Again, I know it provides value in a broader range, but the fact that it's grown like it has been, you know, exciting and fun. And yeah, so we're not quite in the 300s. I think we're able to just episode 230 something this week, but you know, we got
well, congratulations. So DealQuest is the name of the podcast. We'll have that in our show notes. We'll have the link to Corey's book, Authentic Negotiating, and a couple of other goodies there in the notes for our listeners to check out. And Corey, I want to thank you for taking the time. I know you're a busy guy, and I do appreciate it. And I loved our conversation. And sometime when up in the area, we can hook up and have that cup of coffee or adult beverage together.
That would be great. I really appreciate you having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Take care. Well, there you have it, boys and girls. Another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode. Our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.